I call this meeting of the House Education Policy Committee to order, and there is a quorum present. Our first order of business is approving the minutes from yesterday, March 25th, 2025. Representative Mueller, have you had an opportunity to review the minutes, and would you make a motion to approve them?
I have, Madam Chair, and I would move that we would accept these minutes. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Mueller. And Representative Mueller moves to approve the minutes from Tuesday, March 25th. Discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say no. The motion prevails, and the minutes are approved. Well, welcome. We have a very busy day today, so let's just jump right into it with House File 101 from Representative Feist. Welcome to the committee. And since you're not a committee, I will move House File 101 before us, and I believe there is an amendment from Representative Bennett as well. Would you like to speak to the A1 amendment?
I would, Madam Chair. Thank you. So the A1 amendment, let me get the bill out here, removes a paragraph, G, starting at lines 2.26. And basically, it's removing the carve-out that allows various school groups to get a hold of the data that's being dealt with in this bill. And while I understand why school groups would want that to promote or go against referendums, that kind of thing, I just believe it's important to keep this consistent with just applying to everyone, and those school groups can access voter rolls as any other group does. So that's the amendment, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Feist, what are your thoughts on the A1 amendment?
Yep, I am comfortable accepting that amendment. That language was added after the fact, and I agree with you. You know, creating these protections is important, and, you know, there will always be some pressure to create more and more carve-outs, and we can start out without carve-outs. And so I'm happy to accept your amendment. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Feist. So any other discussion to the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say nay. The A1 amendment is adopted. And so now that the bill is before us as amendment, Representative Feist, to your bill.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, committee. So this is going to be pretty brief because we were planning to talk mostly about that part that we just took out. But the goal is just to expand those privacy protections that we created under Chair Becker Finn last term to include families, which was generally the intention. And it was just to address this issue where, like, these scammy for-profit institutions were reaching out to students and had sort of false claims of scholarships and were just kind of preying upon students based on that publicly available data. And so we just wanted to expand that to families. And I can turn it over to my testifier.
Yeah, we'll move to testimony. First on my list is Valerie Dossland. Would you like to state your name for the committee and proceed with your testimony?
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Valerie Dossland. I represent the Minnesota Association of School Administrators, but I'm here also just speaking on behalf of the an acronym of all the other different education organizations that work closely here and often haunt your doors. Thank you, Representative Feist, for authoring the bill. We appreciate clarification in the law so that our school districts are able to comply with the law consistently regarding student data and parent data.
Thank you for your testimony. Next on my list is Rich Neumeister. Is Rich here? Okay. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Neumeister. Please get comfortable, and then when you're ready, please state your name and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. I always like to praise when policymakers make good policy, and taking that little carve-out for school districts to where information about parents can be distributed and probably redistributed is a good policy thing. So I applaud great bipartisanship. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. Is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify on this bill? We'll now move to member discussion. Members, any questions? Chair Bennett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Feist, thank you for this bill. Thanks for taking the amendment. I think it's good to protect data, especially when it comes to students and parents, and appreciate the bill.
Thanks. Representative Feist, any closing remarks?
No, good bill. I would appreciate your support. You have a busy schedule. I'll leave it at that.
Take a note, everyone. And with that, I will move. that, I'll move House File 101 as amended to the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed say no. The motion prevails and the bill is on its way.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Feist. Next on the list is House File 2489, a Representative Burnig bill. Welcome to the committee. While you're getting comfortable, I will move House File 2489 before us to be recommended to be re-referred to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. And I also believe you have an A1 amendment that I will move as well. Representative Burnig, can you explain the amendment for us?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. The A1 is a small technical amendment to a couple of word changes.
Any discussion to the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say nay. The amendment is adopted. Representative Burnig, to your bill.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Before you is House File 2489, a bill brought forth by school nurses. Like last year, I came before you to improve epinephrine delivery in schools. This bill is designed to enhance the safety and well-being of students susceptible to severe allergic reactions by ensuring that Minnesota schools are equipped with the necessary resources and protocols for the effective administration of epinephrine. Currently, districts may stock epinephrine injectors or EpiPens, but as with all technology, things have evolved and we now have pre-measured epinephrine administered nasally. This bill does two things. It removes the language specifying epinephrine injectors or EpiPens and replaces it with epinephrine delivery system, basically an FDA-approved single pre-measured dose. This allows the law to be nimble to accommodate current and future delivery systems. It also provides districts with the ability to obtain standing orders for distribution and condition-specific protocol from the Minnesota Department of Health. Some schools have struggled to obtain standing orders and condition-specific protocol, a requirement to stocking epinephrine. We modeled this after the standing orders for distribution and condition-specific protocol that was established for naloxone. We know that minutes matter, and this will provide better access to districts across the state. I have with me Heather Hedin from the Adolescent School Health Team at the Department of Health to provide technical assistance.
Thank you. Now we will move to testimony, and first on my list is Heather Hedin. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and your guest, and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I am Heather Hedin, the State School Nurse Consultant with the Minnesota Department of Health, and this is my daughter, Caitlin Hedin. I'm here to talk about Bill HF 2489, which modifies the access to epinephrine in schools. In August of 2024, the FDA approved a new form of pre-dosed epinephrine, creating the first nasal epinephrine, which is used to treat severe allergic reactions. Currently, our Minnesota laws are restrictive to allowing only epinephrine auto-injectors to be administered in the school setting and needs to be amended to reflect the new FDA-approved nasal epinephrine to be inclusive of future FDA-approved pre-dosed epinephrine. This is a simple policy change that will ensure Minnesota students maintain access to their preferred emergency allergy medication should they need it. This bill also addresses the barriers schools face in implementing a stock epinephrine program. We at the Minnesota Department of Health School Health Unit have seen an increase in school nurses seeking assistance to find a medical advisor who can provide standing orders and condition-specific order for their districts. This bill would require the Commissioner of Health to provide standing orders and a condition-specific protocol for epinephrine, which would help to eliminate the barrier of finding a medical advisor for districts choosing to implement the stock epinephrine program. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee.
Thank you for your testimony. We will now move to member discussion. Members, any discussion? Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Chair. Good bill. I really don't have a comment on the bill. I sort of just want to say ed policy is so cool because we get so many young people sitting at the table, and I just really enjoy your smile. I feel like sometimes these days get really long, and I'm just so glad that you're here helping. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Chair. I'm thrilled to be, I added myself as an author onto this bill. One of the things that, you know, that we didn't discuss here, but, you know, with, I have a daughter who's got an anaphylactic reaction to peanuts, so we carry an EpiPen all the time, and the nasal, just being able to have that as a different source is huge, especially with the discarding of what happens to that EpiPen once it's gone. So I just wanted to acknowledge that. It is just really important and why we need to keep funding the NIH and other places that are doing this research. So that's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Green. Chair Bennett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And before I give my closing comments, I'll just say I was trying to figure out who the expert was up there, the expert testifier. So I thought it was the person on the right. But anyway, good to have you here. Thank you for this bill. I definitely support it. It's interesting how quickly our laws become kind of obsolete. This one isn't that old. The underlying bill was maybe within the last couple of years. So it's good to keep up with technology. And good bill. Thank you.
Representative Vernig, any closing remarks?
No. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. It's a good bill. So thanks.
It is a good bill. Thank you to the Hedins for your help today. And with that, I will move to re-refer House File 2489 as amended to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, say no. The motion prevails, and the bill is on its way. Next, we are going to move to Representative Green for some discussions. The first one is House File 1982 on transportation. Representative Green, when you are all ready to go, would you like to make a motion to put House File 1982 to be re-referred to the General Register?
Yes, so moved.
Thank you. So Representative Green moves House File 1982 to be re-referred to the General Register. Representative Green, to your bill.
Thank you so much, Chair Jordan. I am really appreciative that we've got some time here to talk about this bill. This is House File 1982, and just I'm going to give a quick introduction and then pass it off to the expert and what brought us here. So. Last biennium, we passed a bill that K through 8 will receive age-appropriate training for pedestrian and bicycles, and that passed. We've gotten feedback from districts that they would like a little bit more flexibility in how they roll that out. And so I'm going to pass it over to my testifier to explain that.
I have one testifier signed up today, Denise Dietrich from the Minnesota School Boards Association. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Dietrich. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Denise Dietrich, and I am testifying here on behalf of the Minnesota School Boards Association, and we are in support of House File 1982. And so, first of all, we'd like to thank Representative Green for bringing this small but really important bill forward. House File 1982 proposes a thoughtful modification to the Active Transportation Safety Training Statute, which was recently expanded to include mandatory pedestrian safety training for all students in grades K through 3, whether you walk to school or not, mandatory pedestrian and bicycle safety for all students in grades 4 through 8, whether you bike to school or not. So we want to be absolutely clear. We fully support the goals of active transportation safety training. Ensuring student safety is a top priority for all of us. What we are asking you to do today is simply this. Repeal the rigid and prescriptive deadlines currently tied to this training. As written, the law now requires that every third grader would receive training in the first 3 weeks of school. Every student grades 4 through 8 must complete their training by the end of the 6th week. And any student who enrolls after the 2nd week is to be trained within the first 4 weeks of their first day. These deadlines may seem reasonable on paper, but in reality, they are logistically unrealistic for many school districts, especially when they occur during this critical and already overburdened 1st weeks of the school year. This is a time when educators are focused on building relationships, assessing academic and social emotional needs of students, supporting students transitioning from summer, welcoming and acclimating newcomers to buildings, and addressing a whole array of startup type responsibilities that our students need when they first arrive to school. Districts also face the challenge of serving highly mobile student populations. Tracking who or who has not received this training can be like a moving target. And we're not even really sure how you find out from a kindergartner if they've had this training or not. So rather than supporting safety, these statutory deadlines add unnecessary complexity and strain to already stretched systems, especially in those first weeks of school. Repealing the deadline does not mean eliminating the training. It simply gives districts the flexibility to implement safety instruction in a way that works best for their students and staff. This is a clear example of meaningful mandate reduction, not by eliminating what matters, but by trusting school leaders to integrate this practice in a thoughtful, practical way. With that, I will conclude my comments.
Thank you for your testimony. Having no more testifiers, we will move to member discussion. Chair Bennett.
This is going fast, Madam Chair. Representative Green, I appreciate the bill. As a former first grade teacher, I can attest how busy those first few weeks of school are. So that flexibility is needed. And anytime we can remove a mandate from our schools, I will celebrate. So thank you.
Representative Green, any closing remarks?
Thank you, Chair Jordan. Thank you, Chair Bennett, for those comments. This is just a common sense. You know, when we pass legislation, we need to always look at how it's implemented. The other thing I just wanted to comment, I do appreciate Representative W. Johnson, who signed onto this bill. So this is a bipartisan effort to talk about, you know, how we can support districts and listen to them. So thank you for your support here.
And with that, Representative Green renews her motion to re-refer House File 1982 to the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, say no. The motion prevails and the bill is on its way. Thank you, Representative Green, but don't go anywhere because the next bill is going to be heard informationally only. So that means no formal committee action will be taken. But we will discuss the bill and hear testimony as we normally would. So thank you for the informational presentation, Representative Green. And whenever you are ready, please present House File 1999 informationally.
Thank you again, Chair Jordan and Chair Bennett. I appreciate the conversations we've had. So I would like to just refer members to the House File 1999 handout. It's like a DE2, I think is what it's labeled. This bill has it continues to evolve through conversation, which I really appreciate. So as a former school board member, I have had a front row seat to this growing issue for many years. So we are going to talk about data requests. I want to make it super clear that the public has the right to request data from a government entity, no matter what the topic is. Access to that data is really important, not only just for transparency, but also for the integrity of what it means to have open government. So what we've seen in recent years is that Minnesota Public Schools have received an influx of data requests. And that in itself is not an issue, but what is an issue is that it's been quietly putting a significant strain on valuable school resources. So what is a data request? Because unless you actually hear how it actually works, it's hard to actually figure out, like, what do you mean data? What does that look like? So I'm going to give you an example. Let's say Mr. Winbird wants to know what training teachers are required to complete every year. What are the teacher training that goes on every year? Mr. Winbird would then have the right under the Minnesota Data Practices Act to ask the district for that data. And the school district, as an open government entity, has the obligation to collect and provide that data for inspection and, if asked, copies of that data. If the request is large, Mr. Winbird would then be also required to pay for copied materials. So what's also important to note is that Mr. Winbird could choose to request the data anonymously if so desired. So what's the issue? The issue is all in the nuance and what I like to call non-serious requests. And here's what I mean. And these are real examples now. One of our metro area districts received a data request from a nondescript email address, anonymous@gmail.com. The district did their job, prepared the data for Anonymous for inspection, but then the data just sat. No one came to inspect it. The cost? $6,000 in district staff time. They reported four of these non-serious request incidents this past year. Another example from a smaller rural district. A request came in, district carries out their due diligence, prepares the data, and again, nothing. The unknown source never showed up to inspect the data. That cost they estimated at $7,000 in staff time and resources. So it costs money to respond and to prepare the data. And it's extra challenging if the request is large in scale, if it's nondescript, or if it needs redacting of personal data. So what does this bill do? House File 1999 is working to find that middle ground between open government and accountability. Accountability both for the authorizer and also the requester. And I think it's really imperative that we strike the right chord here. An element of this is the training and understanding at the district level. That's an imperative piece of this puzzle and how we train and how we districts understand what you can and cannot do within the Data Practices Act. I've been working on solutions on this. I've been started looking at data requests back in 2017. But most recently, since I've been elected, I've been working with the Minnesota's for Open Government group, otherwise known as MNGOGI, with Don Gemberling and Rich Neumeister, who we've heard from already and we'll hear from again, Matt Engling as well. And then I've also worked with the Minnesota Newspapers Association. Free press is a very important issue to me and something I want to make sure that we don't jeopardize with this bill. I've talked with school district leadership and organizations. I've talked with colleagues. Chair Liebling and Chair Scott over in Judiciary have been very helpful with their comments. I met with Rep. Bakeberg this morning about this as well, an issue that he's seen in his district as a principal. And so here's where we've landed. What this bill will do, where we are, is that districts will be able to offer requests for inspection. And then if the requester does not show up for the initial inspection, that data request is closed. And then the inspection is done in person. And so it really is a way to put in statute a little bit of accountability so that we know when a request comes in that it's a serious request. The one thing, too, is I think that this bill then would hold school districts harmless from the non-serious requests. I think it helps to manage the large and complex requests more efficiently. The other thing is that the requests that are abandoned right now also strain the school system, anonymous or not, and allowing the people who really need the data, it gets in the way of that. And then also what we've been able to do is really extend this beyond school districts. So I know this is an ed policy, but one of the things we've really been able to work through, because this is an issue we're seeing in the county, the state auditor's office, across the board with government entities, it really does address that issue as well. It's a bonus to this work, and I think from all the feedback. So I wanted to also bring up, if you guys look at your document, one of the two pieces of feedback that Chair Scott and I spoke about with yesterday. One is she would like to add in some language, which I think is a fantastic addition. Is that the responsible authorities would need to provide the requester at least 5 days notice to inspect the data request, or inspect their data request. I think that's a great add. I think it adds accountability both to the authorizer. I don't know if that's a word. I might have just made that word up, authorizer. But I'm going to go with it. I really like it.
Go with it.
And then also the requester as well. The other piece that I would love feedback on, if anybody has it, is the first sentence in that amendment. It talks about that we may be able to provide data on a rolling basis to a person under this subdivision. And that rolling basis is language that I've gotten some feedback on, that it might feel a little bit restricting for someone who's requesting it, that even though in law you can roll out that data request, but putting it in statute, there's some hesitation there. So,
thank you, Representative Green. And we do have a few testifiers. First on my list is Matt Ayling from Minnesotans for Open Government. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Green, members of the committee. My name is Matt Ealing with Minnesotans for Open Government. We're a nonpartisan, all-volunteer, nonprofit focused on public access to government information. I'm here to speak in support of the amendment that Representative Green is proposing to HF 1999. First, we'd like to thank Representative Green for her hard and detailed work on this amendment. We think it improves the bill and addresses the issues that we had raised to her about the underlying initial bill. This can be a difficult area of law, and we have been impressed with Representative Green's engagement to make sure this comes out correctly. So thank you very much. I want to speak briefly about the technical effect of this amendment. This amendment really codifies existing commissioners of opinion data practices opinions and guidance about how to deal with large data requests and puts it into statute for a point of reference. Large requests are contemplated by the Data Practices Act as recognized by the Minnesota Supreme Court, the Minnesota Court of Appeals, in Webster versus Hennepin County. Our guidance as an organization to data requesters is always to be as specific as possible, try to get at the sort of the nugget of what you're trying to request from the data provider so that you avoid overbreadth and scope. But sometimes we do recognize that large requests are necessary. You can look at the media requests that were made after the I-35W bridge collapse, for instance, very large requests. So there is a time and a place for those. And so because of the fact that these large requests sometimes come in, the Department of Administration has issued guidance over the years on how to respond to these large data requests, essentially by breaking them into components and having requesters either inspect or collect copies for each component, and then having the data providing entity, the government entity, move on to the next stage of that request. And so that's the process that's in the amendment language, and we think it's good to have this as guidance in the statute, because we're always surprised by, we run into people who don't understand that you can already do this as a responding government entity. So it's helpful guidance both for the government entity and the requester. So I'm happy to take any further technical questions, and I'll stand by if anyone has those. Thank you for the time.
Thank you, Mr. Ealing. Next on my list is a remote testifier, Superintendent Elsad from Owatonna. Are you with us?
I sure am. Thank you.
Great. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, my name is Jeff Felson. I'm the very proud superintendent for the Owatonna Public Schools. Thank you, Chair Green, thank you, Chair Bennett and Chair Jordan for this opportunity to speak today and for Representative Green to bring House File 1999 forward. I am the superintendent, have been serving as Superintendent Owatonna for 8 years. I collected some data in regard to this particular legislative action. And over the last 3 years, the Owatonna Public Schools have received 12 anonymous data requests. Out of those 12, 9 of those requests became abandoned. We took time to gather the data, but yet those that requested never showed up to view or inspect the data. That comes with a price tag. With all of those anonymous requests, it cost the district $40,000 to put those items together. Of though at $40,000, $30,000 was in relation to the 9 that were abandoned. So $30,000 of our taxpayer dollars were not used because of the abandonment of that request. I would add furthermore that as the previous testifier commented, these requests can become rather large and onerous. We had a most recent request 3 years ago that cost the district in excess of $400,000 to collect and redact the data necessary for the reviewer. This computes, for those that are in all of you understand education, that this computes into 4.0 FTE. So we, in fact, were not able to hire 4 teachers as a result of this data request. I couldn't agree more with transparency. We want to be transparent and responsible to our taxpayers and constituents. We also respectfully ask that those constituents are responsible and understand the onerous action that it takes for a school district to compile the information, and we would just ask that they then take the time to inspect it. Thank you again, Representative Green, for bringing this forward, and I would stand ready for any questions that the committee might have.
Thank you, Superintendent Elstad. Last on my list is Rich Neumeister. Welcome to the committee again, Mr. Neumeister. Please restate your name for the record and proceed.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. I've been making data requests since I've been 15 years old. I'm 7 decades old now. Before the Data Practices Act, I was asking many questions of Independent School District 625 and Superintendent George Young, because I was a member of a very active student group during those times. So I'm familiar with data requests and the impact, and I've helped many of your constituents, either directly or indirectly, by teaching programs. I get calls from all across the state and helping people. So the first thing you got to understand, the intertwinement of government institutions with our lives. Government has made more and more intertwined with our lives, so there will be pushback wanting to ask more and more why, how come, why are you doing this, whether it be individually or a policy. So there will be more data requests. The thing is, and as Representative Green indicated, and as the person from Owatonna, yes, they do get anonymous requests, and they can cost. But for 50 years in law, there's been training. There's specific dynamics shared with independent school districts and other government entities how to handle large requests. One of those first things is to take a breath and say, okay, what's the scope? How are we going to do this? You don't have to all of a sudden get all the work together. Come on in, Anonymous. The law has been flexible for decades, where you can sort of say, okay, this is a big deal. We can't drop everything. Let's do a little bit at a time. So that goes to my first recommendation that you, Madam Chair, and Chair Bennett may want to do, is put in a writer. Because, again, Don Gemberling made a great statement about Representative Green, listened, engaged, a fast learner. And I also doubled that comment as being one of the unique people that on this kind of issue at first. So I applaud that. And as we have had our colloquy since I first learned about this 12 days ago, one of the suggestions that I made is put a writer in for education purpose as following. I suggested to her to do a mandate that school districts have, you know, hey, let's not put mandates. But what you can do as a writer, because under Chapter 13073, Subdivision 4, the Department of Admin, who's responsible for training, and they get $500,000 to do it, they do public sector training with school districts. It's even mentioned. So if you put a little writer in that says, we direct the 13-whatever, it has to be placed in a certain place here, education, that they do 2 or 3 programs over the next months for all the school districts of Minnesota, so that when they get that anonymous request for everything under the sun, or they get that request from Rich Neumeister that wants 15 years of teacher discipline records, which I have done, they'll know how to handle it rather than, oh, and with the Owatonna situation, if you go in more into it, a lot of it was paid for by attorneys. As you know, there are special attorneys who specialize in school district law, school board law. But if folks were properly trained at the front lines, you wouldn't have to give everything to the school or the special attorney of Knutson or whoever it might be, and your costs are down. The thing that I want to just talk about, and as you know, as Representative Green has been engaged, and I want to thank you, Representative Howard, for your thank you for us folks that we're working, because it's a treat. If you look at the language, it's that first sentence that I have some concerns about. Representative Green knows very specifically my concerns are, because also knowing FOI laws across the country, I've never seen a rolling production or basis put into law, which can cause trouble and concerns. And she has that in detail. If she wishes to share that as part of the discussion, that's her choice. but there's other things that could be talked about. So I'm here just to sort of say I like the amendment, except that one sentence, and I want to thank everyone, and I'm very much obliged.
Thank you for your testimony. I have no other testifiers signed up, so we will move to member discussion. I see Representative Lawrence making eye contact with me. Do you have a go ahead, Representative Lawrence?
Thank you, Chair. I didn't know if you had others in the list or not, so
you're first.
Thank you very much, Chair Jordan. Representative Green, and I just have some knowledge questions, just kind of digging into this and ask some questions for background information. I come from a township background. We were free to set how we wanted to handle this. We spent a lot of time just setting our policy, what we would charge, how much we would invest, who was going to request, how much time the staff would invest in this process. We knew we had to give the data out, but we set the guidelines. Are school districts or school boards not allowed to set their policy? I don't see that dealing with this here, but my first cut says they should be setting this policy, not allowing the requesters to set how they handle it. And maybe that's my first question. Do they have that authority to set the policy and how they administer the data requests?
Representative Green.
Yes, thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Lawrence, for the question. Great question. I served as the policy chair on the Edina School Board, so I looked over our data request policy many times. So the answer is yes, school districts set their own policy, and a lot of times it is based on model policy received from the Minnesota School Board Association. That's where that comes from. I think where the issue has bubbled up, though, is how complex the data requests have come, and typically, I think it has been more specific, and most people, you know, before when data requests would come into a school district, you'd show up at the school and you'd go and look through the files and inspect the data and say, okay, I want seven copies or a copy, you know, these seven pieces of paper copied. So there really wasn't an anonymous issue going on. It's kind of a byproduct, I think, of the digital age that we even have this issue. And so, yes, the short of the answer is yes, districts can do that. And one of the things we've talked about a lot is how do we provide that training? You know, there's, as Rich Neumeister said, you know, this has been around, the Data Practices Act has been around for 50 years. And so to keep up with that training, I think is something that is absolutely essential. I think it will bring down a lot of the attorney fees that we're seeing with districts. So I find this this bill is a both and. We need to be doing both. But I like that we have something in statute to just give more guidelines to that policy making.
Representative Lawrence.
Chair Jordan, thank you. Representative Green, follow-up question. You mentioned anonymous, because I find that surprising that a school district would automatically respond to an anonymous request. Is the school district, school board, required to respond to anonymous requests?
Representative Green.
Yes, thank you, Chair. Yes, they need to reply. And you know, originally when we first started talking, I went in and was like, you know what, let's get rid of anonymous requests. And in digging into that, I had that wrong. I think that's wrong. I think that there are situations where parents, families, or employees need that protection. And not that there would necessarily be retaliation, that's against the law. However, you know, if you were a parent and you wanted to do a data request on a coach, you can imagine what that would be like if that was public for the kid, right? I mean, that's just kind of how things are. And so, yes, for sure. I appreciate your question, and hopefully I answer it. Okay.
Representative Lawrence, any further follow-up?
Yep. Chair Jordan, one small follow-up, because you mentioned a coach, Representative Green. My understanding that any teachers or educators or personnel data would be private. Can an anonymous individual request private information about a teacher or a coach or staff?
Representative Green.
Thank you, Chair Jordan. I'm going to pass this off to the expert sitting next to me.
Mr. Ealing.
Thank you, Chair Jordan. Representative, there is a section in the Data Practices Act called the Personnel Data Section. It's 1343. In the bulk of the Data Practices Act, the presumption is that data is public, unless there's a specific provision that says it's not public. In 1343, that presumption is flipped for government employees. So there's a list of public data in there that includes things like name, work phone number, if there's been sustained discipline, so those files would be available. But the bulk of what an employee does in their employment capacity that's held by the employer, the government entity in this case, would be private. Now, the things that they do for the government entity generally become public. So, you know, emails about policy or the work product that somebody produces for the government entity would be public. But their employment-related details are generally private with certain limited exceptions.
Thank you, Representative Warrens. Next on my list is Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Chair Jordan, and thank you, Representative Green. I will say that before I came here, I did have a conversation with Representative Scott, who wanted me to just kind of ask some of the questions. And I'll be honest, as I'm still trying to understand this issue, can you or your expert here kind of explain what it means to provide data on a rolling basis? That's my first question, Chair Jordan.
Representative Green, would you like to try that, or should I go to Mr. Ewing?
Thank you, Chair. I'll try and respond to that.
Okay. Go ahead, Representative Green.
Okay, thank you. And, you know, I spoke with Representative Scott about that, too. I appreciate the question, Rep. Mueller. And, you know, it is already in law. Like, you're already able to do that. And so in an effort to try and give some more guidelines in statute and how districts can respond, that is why, and from feedback from districts, that's why I put it in. However, I've looked at this over the last 24 hours over and over and like tried it and looked at feedback that I've gotten from, you know, our Minnesotans for Open Government as well. And I think actually the way the statute works, if we were to strike that line, I think the bill would be as effective. And so that's my response, unless I got that wrong.
No, that's our sense too, Representative Green.
Thank you, Representative Green. Representative Mueller, follow up.
Thank you, Chair Jordan. From the sense that I got from Judiciary was that that rolling basis was in rulemaking, but it wasn't in law, and so there was concerns about putting that into statute, and so which again, data laws are so complex and craziness, and so it's really good to try to be as specific as your testifiers talked about as well. So that I just wanted that clarification, Chair Jordan, and so thank you, Representative Green. It seems like you've been doing a really good job with the bill, so thank you.
Thank you, Representative Mueller. Next on my list is Representative Falconer.
Yeah, thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Green, for bringing this forward. As I'm sure that we all have been in talks with our school districts, there's, you know, some financial troubles, if not now, on the horizon. And, you know, I've talked about this with board members, superintendents, and who are appreciative of the work from my district as well. So just from your example of 6,000 times four, I mean, it's $24,000, $400,000. I mean, we're talking about money that could go toward teacher salaries, parasalaries, support teachers, or support staff, programming, whatever it is that's being thrown away on these fraudulent asks or the repetitive asks, whatever your term was. So just thank you. I think this does help go toward solving a problem that is desperately needed, as well as the benefit of saving money that school districts at this point desperately need. So it's really just a comment of thanks and appreciation.
Chair Bennett.
Thanks, Madam Chair, and Representative Green, thanks for this. I really appreciate how thoughtfully you're approaching this, listening to all sides, and I mean, it is a problem that needs to be solved, but solved carefully, because we're dealing with public transparency, and we're also dealing with fiscal responsibility with tax dollars, so we've got to find that sweet spot. I appreciate how you're seeking that balance, so thank you.
Yes, thank you, Representative Green, for some real humans work on this. And thank you to all the advocates that have been very thoughtful and helpful, too. Especially thank you to Mr. Neumeister and Mr. Ewing for all your help. And just as a reminder, members, this was an informational discussion. I think we all agree that we hope Chair Scott and Chair Liebwein will give this a consideration it needs in the Judiciary Committee. So thank you, Representative Green. Any final words?
Yes, thank you, Chair. I just want to really thank the partnerships that and the relationship building in making this work. You know, this is When I ran, I heard this a lot from different school boards. This is it's an issue, and we need to figure. I just love that we're getting to this point where we can give districts some more training and a little bit more so that we can manage this better, and we don't see just money flying out the door, because that I think makes all of us a little angry. So thank you.
And then the last bill on our agenda is House File 1128. Representative Mueller, take your time, get comfortable, and then when you are ready, can you move your bill for us?
Thank you, Chair Jordan. Yes, I would like to move House File 1128 in front of the committee, please.
And my understanding is that you have an author's amendment. Would you like to share a little bit about it and move to the amendment?
Thank you, Chair Jordan. Yes, my amendment is, I mean, this is a very short bill, and but when it was written as a must and a mandate. And even though there is a long on-ramp for the mandate to hold fast to my conservative principles of as few or no mandates as possible, we did have an amendment here that would just say that there is an opt-out for school districts to have this if they're just not ready for it this time. So at this time, I would ask that the committee would adopt the A1 amendment to put this in the shape that I would like to.
Representative Mueller moves the A1 amendment to get House File 1128 in the shape the author would like. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, please say nay. The amendment is adopted. Representative Mueller, to your bill.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, committee members, for taking up House File 1128. So this is about direct admissions program, and it's something that I'm kind of excited about. It's something I've seen in my own district. So as we're thinking about how we are preparing our kiddos for what happens next after high school, it is pretty overwhelming to think about all the different options and abilities. Also, it's also overwhelming to think about what you actually are able to do afterwards. So the Direct Admissions Program, this is an innovative college access program through the Office of Higher Education that uses student GPA at the end of their junior year to determine what Minnesota colleges and university students are automatically accepted into. This is really, I've seen this when I went to my Excel in Ed conference this past November. This was something that they talked about in Utah as well. In the senior year, a student at a direct admissions high school are sent a letter showing, based on their GPA, that they have been proactively accepted into anywhere from 28 to 55 two-year, four-year public and private Minnesota colleges and university. About a fourth of Minnesota high schools in 56 counties are participating in direct admissions, including Austin High School, and we'll be hearing from them in just a moment. Even though this program is only a few years old, it has some extremely promising outcomes. A lot more people are who are in direct admissions. They complete the FAFSA. And there is something really meaningful about the message that, man, I have the ability to do something out, after high school. This, I am college material. I am able to see myself set up for success after high school. According to the Office of Higher Education, in year one of the program, 77% of direct admissions complete the FAFSA, compared to only 51% of non-direct admissions. So how does it work? So this provides high schools through the state more than four years to partner with the Office of Higher Education to become a direct admission high school. This will ensure that by the fall of 2029, every high school, unless they do the opt-out in Minnesota, will have the opportunity to attend a direct admissions high school. The bill guarantees that in the fall, their senior year in high school, current seventh graders have access to the benefits of direct admissions. And so the amendment just allows districts the ability to opt out of specific high schools if they need to. Some districts may need extra time, and so it respects district autonomy. I really want you to hear from my testifiers who at least I'm hoping that we're starting with my testifiers from Austin, because they have participated in this. And in your packet, you will see an article from the Star Tribune. And in that article, the picture that you see, that's from my high school. And so I'm really, and they make it a really big, cool event. And so I'm going to let my testifiers talk about this, Madam Chair, so that we can understand the benefits of direct admissions.
Okay, we will go to those testifiers now. Coming in from Austin, first on my list is Jessica Cabine from Austin Online Academy. Principal Cabine, can you hear us? Are you with us?
Yes, I can. Can you hear me?
Yes. Please proceed. Please restate your name for the record and proceed with your testimony when you're ready.
Hey, yes, my name is Jessica Cabine, and I'd like to welcome you to the principal's office. I bet none of you ever spent time in your principal office when you were in high school, so here's your first run. So, thank you to the chairs and members of the committee for allowing me to testify today. I'm currently serving as the alternative learning principal in the Austin Public Schools, and I'm honored to be here today to speak to you about the impact of direct admissions. This marks our second year of participation, and as we reflect on the journey, I just really want to take a moment to share a really unique perspective. And I know it's not entering into evidence, but I also have another student picture I just want to show. This is from the direct admissions this year. These are the current seniors that received letters, and they're all smiling because we actually do a signing day where all the students come into the auditorium and they get the letter. The unique perspective with this picture and with this class is I have had the privilege of working with the class of 2025 since they were kindergartners. Yes, stick with me here. These students were entering the K-12 system as bright-eyed five-year-olds at the Woodson Kindergarten Center, where I greeted them every day, learned about their dreams, their interest, and their limitless potential as their kindergarten principal. I watched them grow and laugh with them and saw their aspirations take shape. And as luck would have it, I loved them so much, I moved up to the middle school and was their principal during their seventh and eighth grade year, and then moved on up to the high school, too, to continue to help support navigating their challenges and triumphs that come with adolescence. And now we're reaching the final experience in their K-12 system. One thing stood out to me. Somewhere along the way, the bright hopes and dreams and possibilities that once defined these students in kindergarten have begun to tarnish. The optimism that once seemed boundless has been replaced by uncertainty and a diminishing sense of what's possible. For many of them, the dream of higher education has felt distant, if not entirely out of reach. And this is where direct admissions has truly been a game changer for us. Instead of wondering, will I get in or can I afford this, direct admissions has provided my students with certainty. It's given them an incredible opportunity to receive a direct admissions letter to over 55 colleges and universities across Minnesota. This includes a wide range of institutions, from tribal colleges and community colleges to two-year technical colleges and four-year universities, both public and private. For my former kindergartners who are now poised to graduate as seniors, direct admissions is more than a letter. It's a lifeline. It's reduced anxiety. It's eliminated guesswork and opened doors to a world of possibilities. It showed my students that not only can they pursue higher education, but they have access to it. The letter is a tangible reminder that they have options, a certificate, an associate's degree, or even a bachelor's degree. These students now know that their dreams are within reach and that higher education is not just a possibility, but a probability. One interesting fact, again, about this senior class is that I wanted to show you the guy in the blue, the smiling young man in the blue, right there, smiling there, is also my son. So I just really want to call out, I know we love children, so that's my son, Isaiah. Isaiah started kindergarten with me, which is always a joy to have your mom as your principal, just 6 months after entering the United States from Ethiopia, where he spent the first 5 years of his life. Isaiah received support in English language acquisition in the Austin Public Schools through his elementary years, and by the time he entered middle school, again with his mother, love that, he was entering honors level math and language arts courses. But as it came time for Isaiah to start looking at colleges, I began to notice something. When we went on college tours, Isaiah was usually the only student of color on the tour, and I really think he started to notice that too. Direct admissions funding has allowed our district to offer more college visits to direct admission schools, and now students like Isaiah can travel together, visit campuses, and meet alumni who look like them. This has really been a powerful and affirming experience, showing Isaiah and his peers that they belong in these spaces, furthering, strengthening their confidence, and college is a place for them too. Direct admissions is also a powerful tool in closing attainment gaps and promoting college-going culture throughout Minnesota. It ensures all students, regardless of their background, zip code, or financial status, are given the same opportunities to succeed. We are seeing more and more students, particularly those from underrepresented communities, take step forwards toward college enrollment, and that's truly a transformational shift for the future of our state. But perhaps the most meaningful impact is that direct admissions has connected students, families, and schools with colleges and universities earlier than ever before. This extra time has allowed our families to consider options, understand financial aspects of higher education, and make informed decisions about the best path forward. Students can now explore their options, have a sense of confidence and clarity, and reduce the stress of the unknown. I'm proud to share that Isaiah has accessed his direct admissions letter and enrolled in one of the identified institutions for next year. As a parent and a principal, this process has been invaluable and provided me support and resources, ones that would have been challenging to navigate on my own, even with the help of Google or AI. So it's offered me an opportunity that ensures access, reduces uncertainty, and makes the pathway to higher education clearer for all families. So in closing, I stand before you today in the principal's office with great pride and transformation of the direct impact direct admissions has had for our students, for the countless others like them. It represents the opportunity to dream again, and it represents the opportunity to succeed. I really want to thank you for your time, and with that, I'll close my comments.
Thank you, Principal Kabin, and congratulations to Isaiah and to his mom. That's a big deal. So
it is a big deal. Mr. Haugen knows it's a very big deal here.
Well, let's hear about that big deal. Next on my list is Director Haugen. Welcome to the committee, Director Haugen from Austin. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Corey Haugen. Just verify my audio is sounding okay. You can hear me fine?
You sound great. Proceed.
I am the Director of Information Services for Austin Public School Districts. Thank you so much for the opportunity to speak today to our House File 1128 and the Minnesota Direct Admissions Program and the significant impact it's having on students, families, and the community of Austin down here in Southeast Minnesota. At Austin Public Schools, we are committed to ensuring that every student has a pathway to success beyond high school. Our mission is to inspire, empower, and accelerate, and our vision is preparing all learners to make a difference in the world. The Minnesota Direct Admissions Program that we've been doing for 2 years has been a transformative initiative in this effort, removing barriers to higher ed and making college an accessible and realistic goal for more students. As the Director of Information Services, I provide the technical and academic measurement expertise to identify students eligible for direct admissions. In our district, currently more than two-thirds of our students qualify, which is a testament to their potential and the program's ability to recognize their achievements. This initiative provides automatic acceptance to Minnesota colleges and universities, eliminating the uncertainty and anxiety that often accompany traditional college admission processes. And as a parent who's had two children that has previously gone to college before direct admissions, I can say that's an anxious process. They're both doing well, but direct admissions would have been a nice addition to their high school days. Austin Public Schools is a very diverse school district in outstate Minnesota. Our student body of around 5,400 students is approximately 61% students of color. Approximately 60% of our students receive free and reduced lunch, and just over 40% of our students speak a primary language other than English, representing 46 different languages represented in our school district. Diversity certainly enriches our community and our schools, but it also can create challenges for some students to realize their full potential. For many families in our community, especially first-generation college students, the direct admission program shifts the conversation from can I go to college to which college will I choose on that list. This proactive approach encourages students to see higher education as an attainable goal rather than an overwhelming challenge. By providing clear early notification to college, getting that early in the fall of their senior year, students and families can make informed decisions about their futures without that burdened, complicated application process and concerns about eligibility. Over the last 2 years in Austin Public Schools, we've been excited to present direct admission letters to 253 seniors in FY24 and 288 seniors in FY25. And it's such an inspiring and empowering experience to see those students presented with those opportunities that they did not realize that they have. The impact extends way beyond individual students. A more educated workforce benefits our entire community and state. As more of our students enroll in post-secondary programs, they gain skills and credentials that strengthen local economies, attract employers, and improve the overall quality of life in those communities. So direct admissions aligns perfectly with our district's mission to prepare students for success in a rapidly changing world. Simply put, Minnesota Direct Admissions is opening doors that many have otherwise would have remained closed. It empowers students with opportunity, builds confidence in their abilities, and supports the economic and social vitality of communities like ours here in Austin. I urge your continued support of this program to ensure that all Minnesota students, regardless of background, have access to the higher education opportunities they deserve. Thank you for your time and your commitment to Minnesota students, and I stand ready to answer any questions you may have about our program.
Thank you, Director Haugen. I also have one public testifier, Casey Metcalf from Students United. Welcome to the committee. When you're settled, please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Jordan, Chair Bennett, and committee members. Thanks for the opportunity to be here to talk about the best-kept secret in Minnesota education. For the record, my name is Casey Metcalf from Students United, representing 55,000 students across the seven Minnesota State universities. I also spent a decade in the K-12 classroom, so this bill has some personal resonance for me. I've seen firsthand the power that direct admissions has had on my students in Columbia Heights and Minneapolis Public Schools. I've heard from counselors in participating schools who got to share with first-generation students that they were already admitted to their dream school based on their academic merit. Most importantly, I saw students without the benefit of college-educated parents get proactive admission to public and private 2- and 4-year institutions and accept the offer to attend a Minnesota college or university. Today, however, I'm here to share the stories of Minnesota State students who benefited from the direct admissions pilot and support its expansion to full implementation by 2030. One such student is Talia Treblehorn, sophomore at MSU Moorhead. In Talia's senior year, she was called in for a meeting with her counselor at Faribault High School. During this meeting, she was informed that her cumulative GPA had placed her in Tier 6. This meant she was automatically accepted to a wide range of Minnesota institutions, 2-year, 4-year, public and private schools, as long as she completed each school's application as instructed. It also meant that any application fees were waived. This meeting made Minnesota schools Talia's first choice and kept her in-state for her education. Direct admissions benefits not only the students it serves, but also the state of Minnesota. Students who study here, stay here, work here, and pay taxes here. Those interested in law enforcement careers can get information about programs at Alexandria Technical College. They can proactively learn about opportunities at Minnesota State College Southeast in biomedical equipment repair or about Winona State's best-in-class nursing and education programs. When you take out the needlessly bureaucratic admissions process, students can now spend time on career and financial planning, especially in careers where Minnesota currently experiences shortages. Direct admissions has the potential to transform college access across the state. Currently, about 1/4 of Minnesota high schools have opted in, but early data suggests full adoption would put Minnesota at the front of the pack in educational outcomes nationally. According to the Office of Higher Education, 77% of direct admissions students complete the FAFSA, compared to about 51% of non-participating peers. If these high schools were their own state, they would be the number one state in the country for FAFSA completion. Currently, we are 36th. Data also suggests that direct admissions improves enrollment in our state's institutions. These trends hold across demographic groups. Minnesota is a net exporter of college students, and losing homegrown talent hurts our economy. By assuring K-12 students that they are college material here at home, we give them real reasons to stay. The best part about this program is that the data and infrastructure to make it already exists. We are not creating any new programs here. We are simply streamlining data transfer processes and making the admissions process as efficient as possible. Schools keep GPA records, and colleges have well-defined admissions criteria. For a low lift in cost and no local financial burden, the state can leverage existing systems to address workforce needs, improve the admissions process for students and families, and ensure that every capable student can access the quality programs that the state provides. I want to thank the Commissioner of the Office of Higher Ed, Wendy Robinson, and Aaron Solosek at the Office of Higher Ed, for their incredible work in this program, and Representative Mueller for her considered approach to championing this efficient and effective bill. Thank you for your time and your service to the state of Minnesota.
Thank you for your testimony. Having no more testifiers, we will move to member discussions, starting with Representative Keeler. Oh. Starting with Representative Gottfried.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Keeler, for ceding the first question to me, and thank you, Representative Mueller, for bringing this forward. I am very disappointed to see that my alma mater, St. Olaf College, is not on the list of private colleges and universities that participate in this program. And I will add this to as the third bullet point of reasons why they will not get my money until they join. So my actual question, though, pertains to the amendment, and I appreciate wanting to create flexibility in this program, knowing that, you know, some schools, districts and charter schools may not be ready to participate. But what's the actual mechanism for participation? Because of all the benefits of this program, it's a wonderful, wonderful program. One would at least I would think that the schools that already wanted to participate would, and the schools and the amendment, at least from my perspective, and this may be a difference in our philosophical approach, kind of undoes the first couple of lines of this particular thing, because it takes about a 5-minute discussion at a school board meeting to choose not to do this and develop a resolution that goes in writing. So can you speak to the mechanism as amended that this bill would in encouraging participation in this particular program?
Representative Muir.
Thank you, Chair Jordan, and thank you, Representative Godfrey. So I would reject the premise that it takes 5 minutes to just do a resolution and just decide. If you've been, and I'm sure you talked to Representative Green, our school boards are pretty careful on how and do a lot of research on what they want to do and how they want to do it in their district. So if a school board or a school decides that they're just simply not ready or they don't have the infrastructure yet for it, and by infrastructure I mean there is extra work for our counselors. And there is something that we need to, that's something for each of our schools to have to consider themselves. So that in itself, I mean, I know it's a long ramp, but if that's something that the school board is willing to talk through and kind of go through that whole process together, which is a public process with parent input and all of those things, that's something that the school district can decide, which is something why I think is really important to give them that autonomy to do that. Now, one of the reasons why I'm so excited about this is it is a great program, and it doesn't cost anything to the schools other than extra time for the counselors and maybe some extra resources for some extra things to, you know, papers and pens and all those different things. But I believe that cost outweighs the benefits of the program. I don't represent every single school district right now. And so I want, at this point, I really want to make sure that this isn't something, I want to give them that opportunity to have that public discussion while they are considering this as a change for their school district.
Representative Gottfried.
I thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Mueller. I really appreciate that clarification, and forgive my hyperbole with the statement of a 5-minute resolution. I certainly know it takes more time than that. So I'm really interested to see what the uptake is going to be with this bill as written. I'm happy to support it going forward. As somebody that believes in iterative program evaluation, you know, I'm really interested to see in a couple of years what this particular bill yield as far as increased participation in this really important program. So again, thank you for bringing this forward. Super happy to support it going forward too. Thank you.
Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Mueller. I think this is super cool. I want to sort of take a minute because sometimes I think personal privilege and this and how this really does make a difference. Starting with my own educational experience, when chalkboards were part of schools and we would go to the counselor's office, I remember really vividly my senior year always writing my name on the chalkboard because I wanted to talk to my counselor about going to school. She would erase my name and say, "You people always just work at a casino. You don't need to go to school." And I believed that. I believed that for a very long time. And it wasn't until I went to college at MSUM, go Dragons, graduated summa cum laude, moved on to my master's 4.0. Like I was actually smart. What they were telling me and what they were leading me to believe wasn't real. And so I think that this prevents those kind of situations. But then also next generation, I worked in Indian education for a very long time. And up until just a couple years ago, saw this same thing continuously happening. I want to kind of give the principal, I think it's funny that your kid allowed you to follow him all the way through as I was an Indian Ed liaison. When we got to eighth grade, he was like, "Ma, that's enough. You're going to stay there. You're not coming to high school." But I do think that that's really important. And I think being a parent who went to school, I just know the ropes differently. And we do know that we have first generation families that just don't know that. And so I really, really appreciate this and do support it. I think it will be really good work. On some of the just nerdy details about the tribal colleges. And so when I looked at all the lists, I do see
three of the four. And so my first question is this the extensive list, or is this just the list that they kind of shared with you? The reason I'm asking is because Leech Lake Tribal College isn't on this list. And so that's kind of my first question, and then I do have a follow-up.
Thank you, Representative Kiewert. Representative Mueller, do you know we could also ask Mr. Hopkins?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The list that was provided, the list that you got was the list that I was provided. So I didn't compile it. It was a list that was given to me. So if I want to phone a friend, we definitely can see if we have humans in the audience that would be able to answer.
We can phone a friend on the next question.
Okay. JK.
Mr. Hopkins, do you have any information?
Here's my friend, I'm going to phone the next question.
Okay, great. We'll put a pause in that. Representative Kiewer.
Thank you. My next question is, because I see I have Mr. Hopkins here, I was just kind of trying to ask higher education questions. I know this bill refers to Section 136A.84. Nothing in that section identifies tribal colleges. What I'm nerding out just a minute, right, is that do we need to look at updates to that higher ed statute to make sure that schools know that they should be on said list so that they can participate? I just, you know, your school's not on there. One of my school's not on there. So I'm just wondering if we need to lean into that statute at all in higher ed to expand it, tribal colleges particularly, because Leech Lake, White Earth, and Red Lake are not actually in the Minsky system. Fond du Lac is. They're a different entity of tribal colleges. So we can, that would be my phone friend question.
Mr. Hopkins, can you also just let the committee know a little bit more about who you are? You're kind of a guest star today, and then help us out with Representative Keeler's question.
Madam Chair and members, Nathan Hopkins from House Research. I staff government data practices and higher education. Representative Keeler, so I looked up the OHE's most recent report on this program, and Leech Lake is not one of the colleges that's currently participating. There's nothing that prohibits them from participating, but they're just not currently part of the cohort that is participating among higher education institutions. Nothing in the higher education statute would prohibit them from participating. The statute doesn't dictate what kinds of institutions are not eligible for direct admissions.
Thank you. Representative Keeler.
Thanks. I used to sit on higher ed, so I could nerd out a little bit more, but I'll save us all from that, and we can have some offline conversation. That's really it. I really just want to make sure that as we do this on the high school side, that we're also making sure that our higher education institutions know that they can participate in this. And I think some of that is just community outreach and engagement, but also would like to maybe explore when we add things into language, sometimes that does make a difference on who can be drawn in. Great bill. I do really think that this is going to impact many generations, because when we send one generation to school, they start talking about it and it becomes more of a reality for the future generations. Good work. Thank you.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Chair Jordan, and thank you, Chair Representative Mueller, for bringing this bill forward. I just had one question and one comment. The comment that I have is, you know, I love that this bill is here. I think I sit on Ed Finance too, but mental health comes up all the time, and this is connected to that. It is, if you talk to any high school student, the amount of stress they are under, and so to remove the barriers is monumental. It's actually transformational, I think, for the students in our state. So I really, truly appreciate this and could not support it more. My question is, you know, one of the things that we talk about too are our pathways, and, you know, there's been some talk about within Minnesota, keeping Minnesotans here. And so I just wonder if there's any partnership that has ever been talked about with this program with labor, and like how all this fills in, you know, comes into our economic trajectory in our state. So anyway, you might not, I mean, it's more, you don't have to answer that, what the prediction is. I just wanted to bring it up to you to see what that connection and your thoughts on it.
Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Chair Jordan. Thank you, Representative Green. I think the discussions that we should talk about when we look at, like, how we keep kids here for labor. I think those are the type of discussions that we think about with apprenticeship opportunities with our high school kiddos, and that's something I'm certainly willing to have a discussion on. Also, Representative Bakeberg and I have definitely been looking at how do we encourage more pathways to graduation with different opportunities. And if you are able to see some of the places that you can work in the same place that you live, then you tend to stay. And so this program for this specific purpose is what it is, and that's great. A different way is also with those apprenticeships, which would also help our labor area.
Thank you. Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Mueller, for bringing this bill forward. I'm also a fan, very intrigued. I was wondering historically if this is related to Senator Claussen, former Senator Claussen's pilot project to do this, where he was working to notify students and get more students to stay in Minnesota, since we kind of knew that, you know, when the migration out, the age group, we often talk about the older people retiring and moving away, but the largest number is 18 to 30. And so this would address that, as we've heard today. So I'm really a fan of that project and proposal. My question is regarding how the schools promote this program for students during their high school career. I mean, a lot of kids are thinking about post-high school. A lot of them are not. So how do schools sort of activate and get the word out about this prior to them just getting to be a senior and given some tier number if they make it? And then related, what are the percentages of, you know, a little bit more information on those six admissions tiers? I was wondering if some of them almost segment and shift people to college, four-year degrees, and into trade schools or something. So any comments you can make on those multiple inquiries, that would be appreciated.
Representative Muir.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Bierman. For the first one, Representative Claussen was before my time, so I have no idea. But for the second one, if you look, and maybe this wasn't included, and I apologize, they do have a fiscal note that was requested in the Senate. And Office of Higher Education did talk about some of the marketing materials that they would be using to be a little bit more communicative about this program and how they could, you know, share that with other high schools. We could talk to Principal Cabin and Director Haugen about what they do at Austin. As for the six tiers, I would like to tell you that in your research packet, it does go to the OHE's report about what this directly is. And so if you have if you can get this digitally and you click on that link, that will bring you to a lot more detailed information about what each of those tiers are. To be honest, I don't have that information memorized. And so but I can direct you to where you can find it.
And Representative Bierman, it is going to the Higher Education Committee.
Very good. Thank you very much. Supporter of the bill. Appreciate your work. Thank you.
Any further member discussion? Chair Bennett.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Representative Mueller, I love the bill. I especially enjoyed listening to all of your testifiers. They really helped flesh out what this is like in the practical, real world, and what a great idea. So thank you.
Thank you. Representative Muir, any closing comments?
Thank you, Chair Jordan. I have to admit, Chair Cabin and Director Haugen, as you were sharing, I truly miss being in Austin and teaching with you. And I taught Director Haugen's one of his sons, and so the pride runs deep as being an Austin Packer. And to listen to the stories, like I taught in Austin long enough to follow a team, a group of students from 10th grade to their senior year, and watching them grow and develop, and as they come and see what they're capable of. Representative Keeler, your story is adjacent to mine, where I did not develop very well as an academic, truly believing there'd be no place for me to be able to go to college, taking the ACTs and seeing a really low score and believing there would be no way for me to succeed at college. And same with you. I went, did very well, got a 4.0 in my master's, got a 4.0 in my doctorate, like in Go Dragons. And so, I mean, it's when you're able to see yourself differently, you're able to do differently. And that's exciting. Direct admissions meet kids where they're at. It brings the opportunity of a post-secondary education right to the students by letting them know what two-year, four-year public or private colleges and universities they are automatically accepted to in their senior year. It sends a message to students that they are college material. And we heard that from Director Haugen. It's not, oh, I wonder if I can. It's, where am I going to go? I get to make that decision, which is really special to be able to see. The application fees are waived, and I'd even love to be able to see, hey, let's move away from individual. if you're in direct admissions, let's go to a common app and move away from all these millions of applications, remove more barriers. It gives you so many opportunities, and it's something that I am I'm very proud of the students that are at Austin, that they get to see this. I'm proud of being able to be the chief author, but also super proud of the bipartisan support that I've gotten. So many of you have signed onto this bill, and so I really appreciate that. Thank you, Madam Chair. And what I would like to do is re-renew my motion to re-refer this bill to higher education.
Great job. Good job, testifiers. Good job, everyone. Representative Mueller moves to re-refer House File 1128 as amended to the Higher Education Finance and Policy Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say no. The motion prevails and the bill is moving forward. Wow, great job today, everyone. Good job, testifiers. The meeting is adjourned. See you next week.